tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is part 38 of our continuing series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. I am Ted Midward, and this is RadioAryan.com. For the first half of today's episode, we're going to start with an article entitled, Jews as New York Magistrates See Them. The Dearborn Independent has been frequently importuned to make exposure of the Jewish crime record in New York and other cities, but up to this time has chosen not to do so. The material is mountainous and the facts are damaging, but the Dearborn Independent will continue to assume that the majority of the Jewish people do not approve of criminal acts, even against non-Jewish life and property. This paper prefers to confine its attention to those matters which are plainly within the purpose and approval of the Jewish leaders. There is a decided criminal element in the Jewish question, and no small part of the criminality flows directly or indirectly from the attitude of the Jewish leaders, but the great crime is the introduction of corruptive and anti-American ideas into American life, and Jewish leaders cannot escape responsibility for that. The magistrates of every city with a considerable Jewish population know the facts. In practically every state in the Union, there is today a celebrated case where some Jew, through money or influence, is playing horse with American law. It is locally known, but not generally, except in two or three instances. The local press, deriving 80% of its support from Jewish advertising, is usually very discreet, preferring to leave the matter to the courts. Strange things occur in the courts, such as judges being taken into very lucrative partnerships after giving decisions favorable to wealthy Jewish defendants. The following extracts of opinions given the Dearborn Independent by magistrates of the City of New York are offered in the hope that the Jewish leaders will read and digest them and see, if possible, what a hopeless game they are playing. The Jewish question of today is turning about in the direction of the Jewish question of tomorrow, which is, when are the Jewish leaders going to admit that their game is a losing one? They see it now, but they must admit it and quit it. And it will not be surprising if a mass movement of the Jewish people compels them to do so. The Jewish race, said one of the magistrates, seems deliberately blind to its own faults. Some 12 years ago, General Bingham, then police commissioner, found it necessary to call attention to certain criminal tendencies of the East Side Jews. His criticisms were bitterly resented. I venture to say, however, that there are few men who preside in our inferior courts who will not readily endorse those views of General Bingham in their application to the conditions of the present day. In parentheses here it reads, it was because of General Bingham's criticisms that the New York Kahilla was increased in power, not to clean up conditions, but to shut up the critics. Continuing on. The different groups, racial or religious, of New York City have always supported institutions for the care of its fallen women. We have the Magdalene Home, the Protestant Episcopal House of Mercy, and the Catholic House of the Good Shepherd. The Jews alone are the exception, yet it does not require more than short experience in the magistrates' courts to convince one that more than two-thirds of the fallen women in the metropolis are of the Jewish race. This fact and the urgent necessity of caring for these unfortunates was laid before some prominent Jews. They gave the assurance that ample provision was being made by a group of wealthy Jewish families to endow an institution of the kind. However, nothing was done or even contemplated. The Jews absolutely ignored the issue, and today we magistrates are compelled, as usual, to commit such Jewish women to the Protestant, Episcopal, and Catholic homes. This is indicative of a strange refusal to look facts in the face, if the facts reflect on the Jews. A lawyer, once highly prominent in Jewish circles here, became involved in a blackmailing scandal with a notorious member of his race known as the Wolf of Wall Street. The Wolf was convicted and sent to a federal prison. The lawyer was scathingly denounced by the appellate court and only escaped disbarment because of his age. The Jews of New York deliberately refused to condemn this man's nefarious acts. Only the other day, they honored him by dedicating a library to him in one of their charitable institutions and hanging his portrait on the wall. An action such as this smacks a great deal of an absence of moral sense. One magistrate prefaced his remarks by stating that he had no desire to dwell upon any special misdemeanors or crimes that might be considered peculiar to the Jewish race. But he pointed out that a more serious situation than one caused by sporadic criminality had been created by reason of a persistent class movement among the Jews. Any law, he said, which appears to be obnoxious to the self-centered Jewish element is deliberately ignored by them or opposed with a stubborn resistance which neither time nor education seems to mitigate. The result is that our magistrates' courts and the Court of Special Sessions are crowded with cases of violations of that character. The newly arrived Jews especially are apparently determined to subordinate this country to their own desires rather than to accommodate themselves to the conditions here as other races do. The most blatant example of this attitude is in connection with the law relating to Sabbath breaking. Our penal law is plain and specific on this matter. It states, "The first day of the week, being by general consent set apart for rest and religious uses, the law prohibits the doing on that day of certain acts hereinafter specified, which are serious interruptions of the repose and religious liberty of the community. A violation of the foregoing prohibition is Sabbath breaking. Sabbath breaking is a misdemeanor, punishable by a fine or by imprisonment in a county jail, and where the offense is aggravated by a previous conviction, the fine and jail sentence are doubled. Yet the various acts specified as Sabbath breaking are violated openly and with insolent impunity by thousands of Jews every Sunday in New York. Their race has much to say about its own religious liberty, but it thinks nothing of outraging the religious liberties of other races. If any serious attempt were made to enforce this statute in the Jewish districts, the police would be compelled to arrest the larger part of the population. These Jews are determined to trade and traffic and to keep their factories and workshops going on the American Sunday. They impose their will upon the greatest city in the United States through silent resistance and the sheer force of numbers. The Jews of whom I am speaking are mostly from Eastern Europe, Russia, Galicia, and Poland. They are of the first or second generation of immigrants. They generally speak and read only the Yiddish tongue. But it is a deplorable fact that Americanized Jews of prominence openly encourage these ignorant people in their defiance of the law. Whenever Yiddish tradesmen and manufacturers are arrested for Sabbath breaking, hosts of Jewish lawyers spring to their defense, and powerful Jewish societies intervene to protect them. The Jewish Sabbath Alliance, with offices on Fifth Avenue, conducts a constant propaganda among the ghetto people, urging them to insist upon their alleged legal right to pursue their ordinary vocations on the American Sunday, and it provides them with legal counsel when they get into trouble. Jewish lawyers set up the specious claim that these people from Eastern Europe observe another day as holy time, and therefore have a right to labor and traffic on Sunday. Some of the Jewish magistrates encourage this contention by discharging such lawbreakers. But there is no question of religion in these Sunday violations. It is merely money greed. These Jews are so hot after money that they are afraid of losing some if they close their shops on Sunday. This is easily proved by the fact that when the Jews find it to their interest or convenience to observe Sunday closing, they do it by agreement among themselves. This was demonstrated during last summer. In Rivington and Delancey streets, and in fact throughout the ghetto, there were signs posted in the shop windows of Jews authorized by an organization calling itself the Independent Ladies Garment Merchants Association Incorporated. The notice reads this: "This store will be closed on Sundays from June 26th until the end of August. The Independent Ladies Garment Merchants Association Incorporated." In other words, these shopkeepers were spending weekends at the Yiddish summer resorts. They didn't want any of their competitors to steal the trade of customers during their absence, so they all agreed to close up. The question of religion did not enter their minds. Jews of the more intelligent and well-to-do class are also constantly attempting to break the Sabbath laws in sections of the city where their race does not predominate. Non-Jewish merchants have had to organize associations to protect themselves against this unfair competition. If a non-Jew is arrested for Sabbath breaking, he suffers. The Jewish Sabbath breaker goes free. This gives the Jew an unfair advantage. Not long ago, there was a large advertising sign posted conspicuously on the platforms of the elevated railroad. A Jewish wholesale house on Fifth Avenue notified buyers that its sales rooms would be open from 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday afternoon. I thought this was going a little too far, and I called the attention of several of the protective associations to the methods practiced by this firm. The signs soon afterward disappeared. However, such tactics are continually being attempted by Jewish merchants and manufacturers in the Bronx and on the west side of the city in an effort to gain a business advantage over their non-Jewish competitors. But there are means of putting an immediate and effective stop to all this rascality. This would be by enforcing Section 2149 of the Penal Law, which provides for the forfeiture of commodities exposed for sale on Sunday. The section reads this: "In addition to the penalty imposed by Section 2142, all property and commodities exposed for sale on the first day of the week, in violation of the provisions of this article, shall be forfeited. Upon conviction of the offender by the justice of the peace of a county, or by a police justice or magistrate, such officer shall issue a warrant for the seizure of the forfeited articles, which, when seized, shall be sold on one day's notice, and the proceeds paid to the overseers of the poor for the use of the poor of the town or city." This statute is not enforced, but I believe we shall yet be compelled to enforce it in New York. The seizure of the stocks of some of these Jewish shopkeepers would be the most effective lesson one could administer in teaching them to respect the law. Another magistrate expressed himself still more forcibly on the Jewish question. "These people from Eastern Europe," he said, "are tending to destroy all American conceptions of right and justice. Day after day, my court is crowded with Jewish people. I am compelled to fine and warn them. The attitude of the women is especially truculent. They have adopted a misconception of woman's suffrage. They say to me, 'This is a woman's country. Woman can do what she likes. Men can't.' There is no denying the fact that New York is falling more and more under the dominance of Jews. Americans are gradually being driven from public life. It will not be long before we shall have a Jewish mayor and a Jewish board of aldermen. This in itself should be no great misfortune were it not for the tendency of the Jew to abuse his power. He is ambitious and restless to obtain authority. But the moment he gets it, he becomes oppressive. This is evident already wherever the Jews are obtaining monopolies. A friend, a young man, came to me the other day, complaining bitterly that he was deliberately being driven out of business by the Jews. He was the owner of a prosperous laundry, but the large machine laundries of the city are now mostly in the hands of the Jews. They refuse to do his work for him, saying, "You are not a member of our syndicate." Here's an author's note. This is one of the new phases of the Jewish invasion, the almost complete absorption of the laundry business. Continuing on. We all remember the time when the Jews began to clamor for special newsstand privileges. They formed Jewish organizations of news dealers until the business was entirely in their hands. While they still had non-Jewish competition, they were obliging and attentive enough. They did anything to curry favor, but today they carry themselves like lords. No Jewish news dealer in New York will deliver newspapers to his non-Jewish customers on Jewish holidays. In the New York Post Office, where there are now some 11,000 employees, about one half of whom are Jews, the same conditions exist. The Jewish postal employees complained that they were being deprived of their constitutional rights if they were compelled to work on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and on Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. The postmaster was compelled to grant their demands, at the same time pointing out that leaves of absence could not be granted to Christian employees on Christmas, New Year's, and Good Friday, otherwise the post office would be swamped with mail. Another phase of this Jewish insistence upon special rights was emphasized by one of the magistrates. "I have often observed," he said, "that there is generally a good result when a Jew settles in a small New England town where there are only three or four stores. The situation develops social stimulus and competitive spirit. Too often there is a tendency toward dry rot among the native population. They stagnate. But where the Jews assemble in large numbers, as they do in New York City and the industrial towns of New Jersey, they immediately develop a class and racial consciousness that is unfortunate. It is not surprising that Jews should cling to their traditional customs, but it is a peculiar fact that of the 40 different nationalities in New York, it is only one race, the Jewish, that persistently tries to impose its own modes of life upon the mass of the people. One dangerous feature of this tendency is a constant effort to put upon the statute books laws which favor the Jewish race and placing weapons into the hands of the mischievous and litigious. In the penal law of the state of New York, there is a statute which is outrageous in its import and should be stricken from the code. In effect, it renders a man guilty of a misdemeanor if he ventures to have a process served upon a Jew on Saturday. He is equally guilty if he dares to serve a process which is made returnable on Saturday. It is a notorious fact that a large percentage of Jews deliberately alter their names in order to conceal their race. Yet, if a man should induce his lawyer to procure a civil action to which such a Jew is a party to be adjourned to Saturday for trial, in ignorance of the fact that the borrowed American name conceals a Jew, that man renders himself liable to fine or imprisonment. This is Section 2150 of the Penal Law. Its exact wording is as follows. Maliciously serving process on Saturday on person who keeps Saturday as holy time. Whoever maliciously procures any process in a civil action to be served on Saturday upon any person who keeps Saturday as holy time and does not labor on that day, or serves upon him any process returnable on that day, or maliciously procures any civil action to which such person is a party to be adjourned to that day for trial, is guilty of a misdemeanor. Advantage was taken of this statute by a Jew in the city of Rochester to evade the payment of goods which had been delivered to him. The summons which had been served upon him was made returnable upon a Saturday, and upon the return of the Jewish defendant, evidently at the instigation of his Jewish lawyer, appeared in the action for the sole purpose of objecting to the jurisdiction of the court upon several grounds, but more especially for the reason that the defendant was a Jew. Advantage was taken of this statute by a Jew in the city of Rochester to evade the payment of goods which had been delivered to him. The summons which had been served upon him was made returnable upon a Saturday, and upon the return day the Jewish defendant, evidently at the instigation of his Jewish lawyer, appeared in the action for the sole purpose of objecting to the jurisdiction of the court upon several grounds, but more especially for the reason that the defendant was a Jew, and that as such he uniformly observed Saturday of each week as holy time. This case was used to tie up the business of two courts until it was finally taken to the appellate division of the Supreme Court, where Judge Adams rendered a decision in which he said, "In order to give to this section the construction claimed by the defendant's counsel, we must hold that the legislature has not utterly ignored this elementary principle, that to constitute a crime there must be not only the act itself, but a criminal intent must accompany the act, but, in violation thereof, has declared that, while in the case specified, malice or intent must exist in order to constitute the crime of procuring a process to be served on Saturday, or of procuring a civil action to be adjourned to that day, the crime of serving a process which is returnable on Saturday may be committed without any intent accompanying the act." This proposition, it seems to us, has only to be stated to render its absurdity manifest. For the person who served the summons in this action, as is generally the case, was a public officer, and it is fair to assume that he performed his official duty in this instance without knowing, or having any reason to suppose, that the party served regarded one day of the week as more sacred than another. It is true that the defendant is a Jew, and certain racial characteristics may have manifested themselves to such an extent as to acquaint the officer with that fact, but there are other religions than the Jewish that require the observance of the seventh day of the week as holy time, and, consequently, if the rule contended for is to obtain, an officer must somehow ascertain, in every instance before serving a process, that the party upon whom it is to be served does not come within the favored class. Otherwise, he renders himself amenable to the statute. It is conceivable that the legislature intended that a person thus serving a process returnable on Saturday, in ignorance of the fact that he was in any way interfering with the religious liberty of the party served, should be regarded as a criminal. And it is equally certain that a conviction under such circumstances would be absurd and unjust, if not impossible. A construction of a statute, therefore, which leads to such a result, should manifestly be avoided, if practicable. Judge Adams thereupon reversed the judgment of the county court and of the municipal court with costs. "Now Jewish politicians and Jewish lawyers are clever enough as a rule," continued this magistrate. "Therefore, it seems the more surprising that they should waste their time and efforts in placing such laws on the statute books, and trying to establish precedents by means of them. It is very stupid business. The ultimate effect is calculated to bring ridicule upon the Jew and awaken suspicion, dislike, and enmity against his race. Another of the magistrates commented on the fact that in London, Jews were permitted to trade on Sunday by Act of Parliament, but only within the circumscribed limits of their ghetto. "When I was living in London several years ago," he continued, "I was shown one of the Jewish Sunday markets in full swing. Opposite it was an English church, but trade was confined to the Yiddish district. But compared with New York, there is only a small Yiddish population in the British metropolis. Our millions of Jews are scattered throughout the city, and if we were to relax our Sunday laws in their favor, it would mean goodbye to the Christian Sabbath. I cannot understand the attitude of the Jews on this question. They cheapen their own status by this conduct." That is the end of this article. This was published December 10th, 1921, and that means we are halfway through this week's episode. I don't have much to add to this as far as commentary goes. It's pretty straightforward, and we are recounting the story of judges and what they think of how ridiculous these Jews are as they pass these very tedious and trivial Sunday Sabbath laws or Saturday Sabbath laws that more or less create a double standard. Pretty straightforward, I think. And it is quite ridiculous, there's no doubt. Moving on to the second half of this week's episode, the next article is entitled, "Jews Are Silent, The National Voice Is Heard." By order of Louis Marshall, the American Jewish Committee, and the Benign Brith, American Jewry has muffled the calculated furioso of its outcry and its contents itself with now occasional yelps. No longer do the syndicated sermons of the rabbis take their course across the country, saying the same old untrue things in the same old insincere way. No longer do editorial echoes spew vilification across pages supported by advertising blackmail levied upon the community. The outcry has ceased. Suddenly, on order, orderly as a regiment on parade, American Jewry has been turned from a termagant in action to a silent mystery, a most impressive illustration of the inner control exercised by Jewish leaders. The psychology of it all, of course, is false. Jewry decided that it was the attention which it paid to the Dearborn Independent which gave these articles vogue. The leaders asserted, indeed, that had the Jews of the United States paid no attention, no one would have known that they were under scrutiny. It is a rather flattering criticism to lay upon their inability to meet the situation, but it lacks the merit of being true. The Jews of the United States issued the order of silence, not out of wisdom, but out of fear. And not out of fear of injustice, but out of fear of the truth. As soon as the Dearborn Independent issued its first articles on the New York Kahilla, and only, we might add, the outer edges of the facts concerning that institution have as yet been set forth, it became evident to Jewish leaders that something had to be done. They did not challenge a public investigation. Rather, they used discretion, refused to answer even the questions of local reporters, made absurdly untrue denials, and gave every evidence of panic. Thereafter, their safest course was silence. Not that they're inactive. Fearing a sudden investigation by the authorities, the New York Kahilla has grown extremely busy and has doubled the guards all around. Why? The reason is that there is a resolution in the United States Senate which points directly at the New York Kahilla. Prominent Jews have invaded Washington on one pretext or another, but only to turn their influence against that resolution. Why? The reason is that the resolution provides for an investigation by a Senate committee into certain matters which have already been set forth in the Dearborn Independent. Senate Resolution No. 60, introduced by Senator George H. Moses of New Hampshire, provides that the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, which is a Jewish Bolshevik organization that is the feeder of Red activity throughout the country, be thoroughly investigated. In the official language of the resolution, quote, "The purposes, objects, methods, and tactics of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America and its relations, if any, with other political organizations and quasi-political groups, and to make a report to the Senate of such findings." Why has the New York Kahilla closed the portholes and called in help, Gentile help, by the way, to face a possible storm? Why have the most prominent Jews in the United States hurried to Washington to hold conferences with senators, their object being to bring pressure to bear against the resolution? Why should the American Jewish Committee, or members of it, why should Jewish clothing manufacturers, who are the principal sufferers from the Amalgamated, why should Jewish members of the Baruch War government go to Washington to interfere with a proposed investigation? Why? Because such an investigation of the Amalgamated, honestly conducted, would lead straight through to the New York Kahilla and the American Jewish Committee and would rip the Jewish program in the United States clean open to the public gaze, if it were honestly conducted. Next to stopping the investigation, the Jews will try to control it. That is really the greater danger. The country does not need the investigation to get the facts. Most of the facts can be given now. The country does need an investigation that will give the facts a governmental exposure. But a pro-Jewish investigation, an investigation conducted by elective office holders who quake under the fear of the Jews, would simply be an additional crime. If the Jews lose their right to kill the resolution, they have already started on their plans to control the initiative of, divert the course of, and defeat the purpose of the investigation. If, therefore, the Jews are silent, they are not inactive. But the gain has been general. For instance, the country has been given quiet and leisure to hear what the non-Jews think. During the Jewish clamor, which was nothing more nor less than an attempt to stampede the public opinion of the U.S., it was impossible to hear the voice of the people. Ministers who poured adulation upon the Jews were reported in the press, but ministers who seriously handled the Jewish question were not reported. Publications which could be inducted to act as Judah's mouthpieces were worked to the limit. Publications which desired to preserve the value of their opinions did not join the general hue and cry. In the succeeding lull, the still, small voice of American conviction, both Jewish and non-Jewish, began to be heard. In public propaganda, after having felt it inadvisable to print any more telegraphic news from Palestine, because even the Jews could no longer juggle the truth, the spotlight was turned on Russia, and now the newspapers are filled with headlines intended to prepare the public for a new exodus when the Russian people awake to take back their land from the Jewish usurpers. We are told that 6 million Jews in Russia are in danger of violence. It is true, much truer than the miles of telegraphic lies which have been printed about alleged pogroms in Russia and adjacent countries. The Dearborn Independent knows that in Eastern Europe, the Jew has not been persecuted, but has consistently acted as persecutor. The proof of it is in the Jews' ability to flee. They have taken all the wealth of the people of those countries. Poles cannot flee, Romanians cannot flee, Russians cannot flee, but after having squeezed the life out of those nations, the Jews see the dark clouds of justice rolling toward them, and they are able to flee, filling the ships of the sea with their hosts. In fact, their desertion of the Jew-spoiled countries of Europe is as precipitate as was their desertion of Woodrow Wilson and the Democratic Party last autumn. Barney Baruch ostentatiously staying behind to cover, if possible, the shamefulness of it. When the Jew has fried the fat and skimmed the cream, he's off. Gratitude and loyalty mean nothing to his people. They are persecutors in Poland. They are persecutors in Russia. They are persecutors in Palestine. They were the arch-religious persecutors of history, as the best historians testify. They will be persecutors here as soon as they think they can start it. It is possible, however, that in the United States, their antisocial career will be rolled back upon itself. American magazines have begun to pay attention to the Jewish question. It is a good sign. Even magazines cannot long ignore what all the people know. It is a good sign of the degree of freedom the press still enjoys. It is true, of course, that this freedom is not very great. Indeed, not so great as it was a few years ago. But insofar as the press is American, it is impossible for Americans to think it will consent to be permanently gagged even by the Jews. There have been, it is true, some rather sad instances of editorial weakness. We know that of two oldest publishing firms, both of New York, one of them published a most scurrilous Jewish defense by a non-Jewish socialist who, if he has not deliberately lied, has shown too dark an ignorance of facts to command the confidence of a great publishing firm. And we know that that publication was made with a view to the value of the publisher's imprint, and that Jews would undertake to buy tens of thousands of copies for a gratuitous circulation. Of the other old New York firm, it is known that an American diplomat was advised, if not compelled, by it, to eliminate from his forthcoming book nearly one-third of its material because it dealt in an honest, straightforward American way with what this diplomat had seen with his own eyes of the development of the Jewish subjugation of Russia. Had the diplomat been dealing with his own opinions about the Jews or Russia, it might have been different, but he dealt with his official observations on the spot. Observations literally invaluable to history, but this New York firm dared not, even in the interest of history, print the truth. The experience of G.B. Putnam Sons of New York is familiar to students of the question in recent months. The name of this firm is used because it has already appeared in public print with regard to a controversy it had with the American Jewish Committee. The Putnams, acting on their ancient and honorable principle of the freedom of the press, nay more, the duty of the press to inform the people, reprinted last year The Cause of World Unrest, which had first appeared as a series of articles in the London Morning Post and was later put into a book form by the publishing house of Grant Richards of London. Both the newspaper and the publishing house of the highest respectability and standing, as was also the House of Ire and Spottiswood, which brought out the protocols. Major George Haven Putnam, head of the firm G.P. Putnam's Sons, is an American, a fair man, a careful publisher, and one who would not stoop to propagate a lie for any wealth. This is not a defense of the cause of world unrest. In the main, the book is true, but it is not the result of original research. It does not make those small but important discriminations on which the Jews always rely to lead the people astray. It too often links in the downfall of Jewry those things which shall stand independently and gloriously when freed of their present insidious Jewish connections. On the whole, however, it maintains a correct view of world affairs. But it was not a book on which the Putnams could feel obliged to make a final stand, except as regards their right to print it. However, a proper understanding of the book called for the protocols to which the book made frequent reference. So, like serviceable publishers, the Putnams announced that the protocols would follow. Whereupon the American Jewish Committee, which means Lewis Marshall, got busy and an interesting correspondence ensued. It is included in the report of the American Jewish Committee for 1921. Throughout the correspondence, Lewis Marshall was the dictator, but Major Putnam's position and statement of principles were correctly maintained. However, there were personal conferences which are not reported in the American Jewish Committee's report, and there were Jews crowded into those personal conferences whose names do not appear in the correspondence, and there were fists banged on the table in loud threats of boycott, of course, and altogether a rather typical scene enacted. The upshot of that passage was that, upon Major Putnam discovering that the Boston House of Small, Maynard, and Company had published the protocols, he decided that there was no call for his firm to do so. And now, in a letter to these same people, G.P. Putnam's Sons has decided to discontinue supplying copies of The Cause of World Unrest to the book trade. It's a rather interesting story. In Britain, of course, publications of the highest standing like Blackwood's and the 19th Century Review can publish articles on the Jewish question without regard to dictatorial Jewish attempts at control of the press. In this country, however, the spies of Jewry are on the alert for every printed letter and syllable, an attempt to make editors feel uncomfortable, as if they were the instigators of pogroms whenever they present an intelligent view of the question. Yet editors have not been able entirely to ignore it. The reader is rather impressed with one quality common to all the articles that have been written, namely, the facts used are always those that have been given in the Dearborn Independent. Not that they necessarily have been copied from this magazine, but the facts are so well established that anyone who attempts even to defend the Jews must necessarily appeal to the same facts. Thus, in New York in the Real Jew, by Rollin Lind Hart, in the New York Independent for June 25, 1921, this is illustrated. It is pure Jewish publicity, but it must use the facts that have been used in this series. It must use them in order to extol the Jews. Mr. Hart is not to be considered as a contributor to the question. The article is mentioned merely as indicating what the American magazine editor is up against, and perhaps it is not quite fair to be hard on the editor of the New York Independent just at this time. The one flash of value in the entire article is this following paragraph. Ambassador Page, then editor of the Atlantic, once remarked to me, "The most interesting fellow in America is the Jew, but don't write about Jews. Without intending it, you may precipitate the calamity America should be most anxious to prevent. I mean, Jew baiting." That is a strange assertion. The Jews must not be written about. To write about them, even with good intent, may bring evil upon them. Not only a strange assertion, but a strange situation. To mention the Jew has always been dangerous to the non-Jew, but why also dangerous to the Jew? The Jewish explanation of anti-Semitism, that it is in the blood of other races, that the moment they see a Jew they hate him, cannot be defended. Most non-Jews can testify that it is untrue of them, but it is a most amazing condition if even a mention of Jews arouses this feeling. Why should it? However, the statement is of doubtful fact value. The Jew himself should be the first to protest against having to go concealed all his days. He should welcome the use of his definite racial name, and he should not demand that it always be used in laudatory connections. A Jew should not be a Jew when he is elected to the United States Senate, and a Russian or a Pole when he is caught bootlegging. He should take the luck of life with the other races, and this would come to him without discrimination if he did not first arouse the spirit of discrimination by insisting on discrimination in his own favor. It is probably much nearer the truth to say that publicity is a preventive of Jew baiting. People should not be confined in a condition which makes the use of the word Jew unusual. It should attract no more attention than does the use of any other racial name. Mr. Page was, before his ambassadorial days, and editor of the Atlantic Monthly, a magazine which is an integral part of American life. To read the Atlantic is a certificate of character. It is one of the few publications that preserve the American spirit in literature. It is still worthy of the glory of the group that first made its name known wherever sound thought expressed in good writing is appreciated. The Atlantic is not in need of this appraisal. It is too well established in the regard of the class of minds that give color and sinew to our intellectual life. In Mr. Page's day, the Atlantic may never have touched the Jewish question with even so much as the tip of a discreet pen. Nevertheless, the Atlantic has in more recent years done its duty towards this as toward other questions. As far back as 1917, and that is very far back in view of the crowded years between, this old Boston magazine contained an article relating to the Jewish question. The fact that the article was written by a Jew does not militate against it, but rather adds to its value. It contained valuable suggestions which the New York Kehillah and the American Jewish Committee might well devote the remaining years of their activity to disseminating and actualizing among the Jews of this country. Even today, its counsel would save them from much of the folly which marks their attempts to combat what they call persecution, and which is nothing but rather plain and charitable truth-telling. This year, the Atlantic has contained three articles of value on the Jewish question. The first was by Professor Clay upon the situation in Palestine. Now, Professor Clay is not an anti-Semite, and certainly the Atlantic is not, and yet the article was received with a good deal of abuse from Jewish quarters. It told nothing but the truth, and it was rather pertinent truth too, which intelligent Jews doubtless welcomed. Professor Clay knew what he was writing about, and his conclusions are not challenged by any authority on the subject. In the May edition of Atlantic, Ralph Philip Boaz, who is understood to be of Jewish descent, wrote an article on Jew baiting in America. He speaks rather disdainfully of publications which have endeavored to air the Jewish question, but after having thus paid his tax to the Jews' prejudice, he proceeds in commendable fashion to contribute his thoughts to the matter. On the whole, what he says is true, and the facts he uses as his foundation are, of course, the facts with which the Dearborn Independent has made its readers familiar. He sets up his straw man of anti-Semitism, and after having valiantly destroyed it, to the applause of all of us, he gets down to serious business and says some things which all could hope would pierce the Jewish consciousness to its innermost stronghold and set up new vibrations there. And in the July edition of Atlantic, Paul Scott Maurer, Paris representative of the Chicago Daily News, has an article on the assimilation of Israel. Mr. Maurer has won the respect of students of world affairs by the conscientious ability with which he has observed and reported big events in Europe. In his news reports, he has not hesitated, when the facts justified it, to cable a story of Jewish participation in this or that movement. It was reported at one time that an attempt on his job had been made by certain Jewish influences, and it is certain that sections of the Jewish press bitterly attacked him. Yet Mr. Maurer is probably no more interested in the Jewish question than the many other big problems which have come within his journalistic ken, and it would be extremely unfair to regard him as in any way a propagandist for anything. Mr. Maurer talks about Israel when, of course, he means Judah. There is a deep distinction there, and he talks also about assimilation, which the Jew will not admit as a solution. He protects himself fore and aft by attacking the anti-Semites, whoever they are, and by expressing his confidence in the Jews, but on all the decks of his articles he gives the facts, and they are the same facts. It ought to be pretty well settled by this time that there are facts, not two sets of facts, but only one set of facts, concerning Jewish influence and activity. The world's work has taken the liberty of setting before the people the only real anti-Jewish article that has appeared in the United States since the present discussion of the question began, and that article was written by Henry Morgenthau, a Jew whom the government is accustomed to honor whenever it would pay a compliment to the Jews. It turns out that he attacks Jewry in its most tender spot, Zionism. Many people have read it, for it was immediately turned into propaganda and published in a host of newspapers, and many of them as first column, first page news. Mr. Morgenthau said that Zionism was not a solution, but a surrender. He attacks the whole Palestinian plan from every angle, and not only attacks, but belittles it. Of course, this is very interesting, but one doesn't understand the heat that's played. If the Jews wish to go back to Palestine, why all the objection? Mr. Morgenthau does not wish to go back, it is true. It is extremely difficult to find a Jew who does want to go back, but to desire a national land for the Jews is quite another thing, and most Jews desire that. The pity is that they carry into Palestine the same method, which puts them upon question here, and they are in danger of tipping over the apple cart in their imperious disregard of the rights of men in Palestine. Mr. Morgenthau's motive in writing the article must remain a mystery, because it would seem to leave him practically outside of American Jewry, and of course, he is not outside. Not at all. Watch and see. His article was printed in a magazine, read and supported by non-Jews, and was intended for non-Jews. It was not a plea to his people. It was a kind of confidential explanation, whispered from behind the hand to non-Jews. Mr. Morgenthau knows that Zionism is the core of Jewry in this country. The Zionists rule. The Zionists, and not the Americans, dictate the policy of American Jewry. The Zionist program was the only program that went unaltered through the peace conference at Versailles. Zionism is the heart of Jewish aspiration. Not of American Jews, Mr. Morgenthau may retort. But who are the American Jews? Inquire of the recent convention of Zionists at Cleveland for information. That convention is worth a story by itself, but it explains why the World's Work stopped its press for the July issue and made an insertion of 8 extra pages for the accommodation of Mr. Morgenthau's article. The Jews who called themselves Americans had been thrown down and out by the Cleveland Convention, and Russian Jews proved themselves the stronger. It was an event that called for quick explanation. The humiliation of the Americans was something to be covered as speedily as possible. Why the World's Work should have been chosen as the vehicle is not known, but the presses were stopped and the Morgenthau backfire started. Mr. Morgenthau's article as a Jewish pronouncement is negligible, but the editor's note that preceded it has the value of unbiased testimony. Referring to the World Organization of Zionists, whose chief officer stepped over here from Europe and simply slammed the American Jewish leaders out of the office, the editor of the World's Work has this to say, quote, "This world organization has a highly centralized form of government. This consists of an international committee, including representatives from all countries that have a local organization. But the real control is vested in what is known as the Inner Actions Council. This is a compact body of only 7 men, and it is dominated by the Jews of Europe." End quote. The Jews of Europe, as it is written, might still be more definitely described as the Jews of Russia. And Dr. Chaim Weizmann from London might be more accurately described as Pinsk from Russia. The Russian Jew won, as they have always won, for they are the originators and corruptors of the false political Zionism which is leading so many Jews to disappointment and distress. The point in all of this is that in the silence of the Jewish regimented protest, the voice of the country has had a chance to be heard. The religious press has not been mentioned here, for it deserves a separate account. nor have the many newspapers which have reacted from the previously imposed burden of Jewish propaganda. Editorial speech is becoming freer. Jews themselves are coming to see that the call is not for abuse, but for a cleanup. The expression of the press of the country indicates that there is a Jewish question and that the Jews use the worst possible tactics in trying to suppress the knowledge of it. They have behaved in a way to show what bad masters they would be if given the chance, and what essential cowardice controls their actions. One by one, the holds they gained by force of fear are being loosened, and if the Jews would lay up capital on which to draw, the capital of public confidence, in their desire to do the right thing, they would go around and loosen the holds they still have. This, however, is not expected of them. It requires too much foresight. That is the end of the second half of today's episode. I hope you all have enjoyed. Until next time, praise Christ, praise Yahweh, take care.
Tuned into Radio Aryan.